So we have a lot of personal experience with the whole category, as well as an interest in people's narratives and how they talk. And what we're going to do today is talk about the whole ever sharing thing. Get the next slide, please. So how many people know who Emily Gould is? Okay, we're going to talk about her. Next slide. Slide after that. Okay, if you wondered what oversharing was, I hope we just showed you. With the live stream, everything happens so quickly. Next slide. Let's talk about what we're going to talk about, and then we'll talk about it. Okay?
We're going to talk about sex and relationships, when is it oversharing, how transparent you want to make your life, and how all these social media services make it very easy for people interested in you to keep in touch with you or to stalk you.
Now, at one point in my life, I actually ran Yahoo Personals, which for somebody who got divorced was a great way to eat your own dog food. And we're going to talk at the end about the whole idea of security and privacy and safety, because as you'll see, a lot of the bloggers we focus on who've gotten a lot of attention, both welcomed and unwelcomed, are women. Next slide, please. We're going to talk about a lot of different people, but first I want to just make a couple of key points.
The internet is forever. I had my first email account in 1988. If I go and look for myself on Usenet, I can find many things back to the 80s. Right? You want to think about what happens if someone Googles you, prospective employers are Googling you and looking to see what pictures you put up from your party Saturday night. How will you feel when you read your own writing many years from now? Next slide, please.
So basically, we're going to start with a few people who, deliberately or not, we consider as being successful at having made themselves notorious. In addition to Emily Gould, who had a cover story in the New York Times, we're going to talk about Julia Allison and also about the whole Jenny Jardin boing boing thing. And we thought of like 30 examples. So these are more illustrative of points we want to make than we're trying to single out any one person. Next slide. So let's go to 2007. Julia Allison is a blogger writing for Time Out magazine in New York City. Her boyfriend is the editor-in-chief of Men's Health, the incredibly hunky David Zizenko, who also dated Rose McGowan. This girl's narrative is, I want to be really successful and well-known. I want to have a rich and powerful boyfriend. She comes to the Valley and goes to a TechCrunch party. Next slide, please. Wow! Next boyfriend, founder of Vimeo, high-tech nerd. All of a sudden, we're into live stream in a deep way. Julia and Jacob are blogging, they're Flickering, they're Twittering, they're Vimeoing. They set up a site called Jacob and Julia to chronicle the back and forth of their relationship. Are they attention whores or deconstructing it? Nobody's really quite sure. But then they have this very public breakup and a lot of really personal videos, and she gets more and more attention, and people start to turn on her because, you know what, she always poses with a certain side to the camera, like it's not very natural. So reblogging Julia happens. Someone is using a Tumblr blog to basically make fun of her with her own words and her own statements, and she goes point to point about that. And then, next slide, please. What happens? People get pissed off at her and they laugh. But what does attention get you? Next slide, please. In our world, it gets you the cover of Wired. 2008, Julia gets the cover. Maybe she's the Paris Hilton of the internet. But you know what? That cover is one of the best-selling Wired covers in all of their history on the newsstand. Think about how many years of magazines that is. Who's gaming whom?
Any comment before we go on?
Next slide. Okay, another use case here. Emily Gould gets out of school, does some writing, goes to Gawker. New York, Nick Denton, Rag, part of the same network as Valley Wag. Next slide, please. Starts out writing about other people, but you know what? Her personal life is juicy, and her readers want to hear about it. So she starts to kiss and tell. Only you know what? Her boyfriends don't always know that. Next slide, please. They get upset. And then what happens, Emily gets upset. And when Emily's upset, she doesn't want to blog anymore. She resigns from Gawker. It's terrible. Well, you know what? Emily, too, has an amazing comeback. Next slide, please. She sells her story full of repentance and pain to the New York Times. It's a cover. Over 1,500 people respond just on that site. It's all over the blogosphere. People are mad. They don't like this narrative of, I told all and I'm really sorry, and they rage at her. But she has a reported $1 million book deal. Next slide, please. One last case, one that's probably pretty dear to my heart as someone whose roots are in the valley. Boing Boing, one of the most popular blogs on the net. Jenny Jardin, well-known tech personality. Violet Blue, local heroine. Are they unpublished or deleted? Whatever it is, the posts disappear. Nobody notices, and then someone notices. And what happens? A firestorm breaks out. Next slide, please. So Violet is upset, but Jenny says, it's personal, I don't want to talk about it. Can we go to the clip? This is a great example, and we're going to kind of transition here a little bit, about reputation management and getting an effect that you didn't bargain for like Jenny did. And then doing a really masterful job of kind of having your say without saying too much like Violet did. Let's just play a little bit of Violet's YouTube before we turn it off.
This is all the time. A formal blog about Boing Boing removing all references to me on their blog. That was 78 posts and counting. We're still counting, saving a little bit. I need extra time. But the point is, 78 weeks. And no one really still knows why it happened or why they behaved the way that they did. And people are still asking me about it. Major media organizations are still asking me about it. People are leaving comments on my friends' photos, on their Flickr photo streams, asking them what happened. I think the best way to answer this question is in words of my filter commenters. So here's that one boring thing as told by my filter commenters. Someone asked, hey, what's going on here? We're all posted. Let me try to sum up. BB's stuff is all gone from BB. Why do I care about this? Hey, this is a little weird. Imagine this on BB. Hey, BB is submitting in comments referencing BB. BB says she has no clue. I know the blamers, and they are great people. So what? You're a poopy head. No, you're a poopy head. Hey, I was a jerk. Hey, so was I. Oops. Whoa. BB posted a response, but it doesn't say much. It's personal. Maybe it's the trademark that BB uses now. BB are hypocrites. Maybe it's a leather strap. This is a long thread. Sounds like sure it's trashy. Whoa. The moderator over there is calling BB a liar. Hey, they're still changing this stuff and not being so sad about changing it.
Great. You get the idea.
You get the idea. Couple of comments. Just think about how each of these people in some ways got what they exactly wanted. In other ways, maybe they didn't.
Violet's a good friend of mine, and we had a discussion about this, and I think what she doesn't really understand is what still really happens in all this. Oh, okay.
Yeah, we will try to shout more into them.
I'll hold it closer. Sorry.
Okay, let's look a little bit at the next set of people. Next slide, please. Okay, one after that. All right, Zoe Margolis. Let's let you talk about Zoe.
Zoe Margolis, her blog was The Girl with the One-Track Mind. Her pseudonym was The Girl. She started blogging very early on about her sexuality, about her thoughts. She was a film assistant in 2007. On the eve of publication of her book in England, she gets an email from Nicholas Helen, the editor of the Times of London, saying, we know who you are. Either you come in and have a picture, we do an interview, or we disclose your name. It caused her tremendous anguish. Photographers staked out her family. She is no longer in the film industry, and she's making a living as a writer. And she's moving to New York because she has pretty much had it with London.
Next slide, please. So here's somebody, again, on the list of cost and notoriety who's become so famous in London that she feels she can't have a date. Online dating, they know her picture. Real world dating, they're like, are you going to write about me?
Right, and if you read her blog, the tone of her blog has changed considerably. She's not really writing about her thoughts and feelings anymore.
So the point we want to make here is that, you know, you can construct your narrative and it may not play out the way that you thought it would. Certainly I don't think it did for most of the people we just talked about. And a lot of it has to do with reputation management and how you interact with the people known as your audience and your community. But before we dig into that, we also want to show you some people who we think have done a really good job of being in the public eye because of their transparency and their personal stories, who haven't necessarily lost control of what people think or say about them. Can we get the next slide? So let's ask a couple of questions here.
Are women who blog about their sex lives, are they considered sluts? What's the difference between a man writing about his coke habit or a woman about how many sex partners she has? Okay. Are we all sex phobic?
I mean, how could this story really be different? Let's have the next slide. Okay, these are bloggers who we think have ridden above the fray, even though there's definitely been a fray. So Melissa, Rachel, Rex, Nick, these are all people who have definitely been in the public eye, but it's played out a little differently. Let's go to the next slide. So Melissa is a former sex worker and a sex worker rights advocate. She's done a lot of personal blogging, but also started blogging for ValleyWag. And we asked a lot of these bloggers about their philosophy of how they manage their life and their narrative. And Melissa's comment was, I will always out myself first. Nobody can hold anything against me that I've put out there first. I think that's probably held pretty true for her in terms of how she's managed some of the politics and the firestorms of things that have happened around her. Next slide, please.
Rachel Kramer Bussell is probably one of the hardest working erotica editors and writers I know. She works full-time at Penthouse Forum. She curates reading series. She is editing many different anthologies, and she is masterful at her use of various social media platforms and blogs to get the word out about her work.
Next slide, please. Rex Sorgatz, another New Yorker, wrote a piece that's really tied into this idea of your personal narrative, which was the micro-fame game. Rex is in a very high-profile relationship with the woman, Rachel Sklar, who's the managing editor for the Huffington Post. And this is a couple, unlike some that we've seen, who've managed to share Flickr stream, Twitter, blog about each other, and yet there's a clear line where, you know, the catfights and the spats and, you know, the things that, you know, we might love to hear about, but we shouldn't, just don't get aired. So somebody who understands microfame as a journalist, but also is really adept at playing with it as a blogger and a personality. Next slide, please. And last of all, in some ways my favorite, Nick Douglas. If I wanted to be cruel, I'd ask how many people in the audience know who he is and do they think he's a fuck-up? And the reason I'd say that is because Nick would tell you he's a fuck-up. When I talked to Nick, what Nick said is, you know, I'm 23 years old, I'm going to screw up. There's a lot of stuff I don't know. And I'm going to screw up in public, and I think that's a great way to learn stuff. I mean, how much more Teflon clayed can you get, right? How can you have someone else, like, deflect your narrative when you're willing to be shown up and be that vulnerable? You just can't fault that. Next slide. So, the big questions we're going to talk about with you, and we're hoping this could actually be interactive because I'm sure that a lot of you have both thought about these things, weathered your own storms, and had your own experiences, but how do you draw that line between transparency and oversharing? What's the place where you can really make it work? And what we want to do is share observations, not only from us, but from other people that we talked with.
Next slide, please. One of the things to think about is, what is your narrative going to be before you put it out there? Once something is out there, as we've seen, it's enormously difficult to take it back. I know some of this seems like common sense, but lots of times people text in anger, blog in anger, blog when drunk. So think about what you are willing to do or not do in these situations. I know plenty of friends who are very high profile, and their agreement with each other is, we're not going to discuss anything online, whether it's in a locked live journal, we're not going to tweet about anything. Other people, it's all out there. Okay. Tone is also very interesting. I have a blog where I link to a lot of things. I don't really provide much commentary. Other blogs, such as Jezebel, are famous for their tone and their snark. How much do you want to share? I personally share very little, but if you read some of my friends, they share about me. Do you have anything to add about that?
I have a blog that's a tech blog, pretty much, Susan Mernitz's blog. And when I got divorced, I had a secret blog, but I don't keep up anymore. But now I've been writing a blog her about sex and relationships for a long time. And when I started doing that, I thought, oh, none of these like geeky people are going to go over there and read my stuff about, like, you know, dating and being single and, you know, all the things I think. And that was completely untrue. I think in truth I've probably gained a lot of woofy because people go over there and read about my experiences with, you know, non-monogamy or breaking up with someone, and they're like, wow, this person is so human. Wow, that is really cool. And it's been a very humanizing kind of thing. But I think I sort of was in denial a little bit in the beginning of how much they really were the same audience. And there's probably a good, you know, 40% overlap, which is higher than I expected. So for me, that idea of, you know, think about how to be consistent in your identity and what you are going to share is really worth it because someone gets interested in you, they can start to Google your name or put alerts on it, and they'll find all kinds of stuff. So be aware, you know, that you've made the choice to put it there.
I think that's a geographical thing. I'm in New York, Susan's in San Francisco, and here there's a lot less demarcation between personal lives and work lives. In New York, almost all the bloggers I know are writing under a pseudonym or very closeted. All right. Next slide, please. Okay. One of the things you can think about is having a strong public image out there to counteract any negative issues. You are who you write or you link to. Having a blog role who shows who you're colleagues are, who you're reblogging on Tumblr shows your affinities. It's very easy to build relationships online and in real life, and when the yogurt hits the fan, you learn who your real friends are, and you learn who will come to your aid and defend you.
So the point here, just to put, like, you know, a real blunt spin on it, is you're going to end up with two kinds of community. The community of people you know who are connected to you in the real world for whom all this blogging and live streaming is going to deepen your connection, and then people who find you online in a random way, which for some reason you can't necessarily fathom. They want to follow you on Twitter. They want to read your blog. They want to look at your Flickr stream. They want to read you. And, you know, you may not even ever know why those people have that degree of interest in you. But if there's a lot of them, you basically have a community that you're not really in control of. It's not a community that you can literally touch. It's not just your friends who say, oh, I heard you're going to Italy. And it's like, oh, yeah, I blogged that. You know, it's people that are beyond what you can see. And that's a really important thing to be aware of because it's something that can create a lot of tension in your life.
Next slide, please. Okay. How do you know what people are talking about you? There are lots of different monitoring services. I personally use Google News because it gives you a comprehensive search either in blogs, Usenet, and news. I also have an alert set up for my name, my URL, and my email address. The email address is interesting because over Labor Day weekend, I discovered a leak in an affiliate account system that I use. So what an affiliate account is, on my blog, I promote certain websites. And if you, the viewer, like a particular picture and you click through to that site and you sign up, the website that referred that user gets a certain amount of income. Most of my affiliates are pretty naked girls. Some are sex toys. So with this security leak, if you knew to search for a particular email address, you saw the email address in the affiliate administration system, and you saw the user's real name. Luckily, the vendor was extremely responsive in resolving the issue, closing the loophole, and working with Google, but the information is out there.
So in other words, part of what we want you to think about with the narrative is not just the narrative that you craft in terms of how you present yourself, what you decide to share or not share about your activities in your life, but all the eddies and the ripples that creates of people around you, both how people are responding to you and then what they're posting or saying. Because the moment's going to come where basically you're going to have a troll or in some way some part of your community is going to decide they're going to bite back. Next slide, please.
Okay, we talked about communities and piling on. The mob mentality, if readers smell blood, they love to pile on. An example of this is a blogger in New York who's a very good friend of mine named Jefferson. He is very open about his lifestyle and his sexuality and his many partners, and he is also very open about his love for his children. He was interviewed in Time Out New York, and his ex-wife found out about it and sued for modification of custody. And he put up an appeal because the Sexual Freedom Legal Defense and Education Fund agreed to organize this fund for him. Whereupon some other sex bloggers said, we have a real problem with this. We disapprove of your lifestyle. We don't feel that you should do this because you've already put up other appeals, and other people started piling on. Turned into a real free-for-all, comments were closed. Someone came on who said, oh, it's really easy to out you all. I think I'll put a blog up to that effect. And eventually the person started linking to Jefferson's real-life work, and it's pretty easy to kind of figure out who he is.
How many people in this audience have had an experience of a stalker or a troll? How many people have a friend who have been harassed in some way through social media activities? Yeah. So we want to talk a little bit more about the whole idea of privacy. Next slide, please. Because what you have to do is think about what your platform is and what you want to work with and how to protect yourself. Can we talk about the platform a little bit?
There are lots of different platforms. Some people have been blogging on LiveJournal since the early years, and it's very easy to find different communities through LiveJournal. Blogger is a standalone blog interface. WordPress, the hosted service like WordPress.com. With some services, it's very easy to lock down an entire blog, such as Blogger. With standalone WordPress, you can lock down posts on a post-by-post basis, just like with LiveJournal. LiveJournal gives you a friends filter. It's also called by some people I know drama journal, because people write, you know, with certain intents because they know certain people are going to be looking at it. Tumblr is a newer platform, and depending on the media format you're going to use, that is the way the post will be formatted. It doesn't really have comments. Some users hack into the template and use comments. So the way the discussion occurs in Tumblr is to, quote, reblog. Copy the post, add your comment, and then you can see as a user on the dashboard who's reading you, who is quoting from your blog, or copying you. And you can kind of see the whole train of discussion go on. So instead of a commenter saying, you're an asshole, people set up anonymous blogs and comment on another blogger's every post. So that's the phenomenon dubbed the Anonymous Bloggers by Eric Crandall of Silicon Alley Insider. Okay? Real-time Twitter and friend feed is, how many people are in this room are on Twitter? Okay, I'm on Twitter too. How many people are Twittering right now? So, Twitter, I personally have my tweets locked, but conceivably anyone can follow your tweets. And you can RSS them. Friend feed is an aggregation service where you can collect all the social media services you are using. So if I pull up Susan's friend feed, I see she's made a tweet here, She's posted a picture. She's posted a blog post. She's favorited a song on Last FM. All these services provide a really complete profile about someone. And even though you see all this information and you think you know someone, you don't really know someone.
But that's where the whole idea of microfame comes about, right? Because some people can become very popular for pieces of that. The Flickr photographer with thousands of contacts, or the person on Twitter with thousands of followers who's actually not a bot, right? Because there are people on...
Like Robert Scoble.
You know, that's right. There are people who are fake, but you're a real person who's very flirty or interesting and has all these people following them. But, you know, if you're in the center of it, if you're the person who has the narrative, on one hand you can say you need a really thick skin. I mean, Robert Scoble's a great example of someone who's a famous tech blogger who's been called a jerk, you know, over and over, and is pretty good about just being impervious. But then there are people who can feel incredibly damaged. So I want to talk for a little bit about the whole idea of, you know, how do you protect yourself and how do you manage your privacy and how do you think about, you know, those crowds, because we're not suggesting that anybody not use all these social media tools. You should decide what you want to disclose and what you want to share, but the fact that we can, you know, share as much as we want to about ourselves is really powerful, in my opinion. I think it's something we need to be in control of, but the fact there are problems with it is an education issue. It's not a reason not to do it. Let's talk a little bit about the next slide. So Vivian is an expert in privacy. She's counseled a lot of people who need to be very discreet, and a lot of these are her tips and observations.
Well, I just wanted to say a couple things about going back to the mob mentality. It's easy when a flame war erupts or people start reblogging you to go crazy as the reader and want to read everything and comment. You can do that, but after a while, it's incredibly wearying. You know, there are certain bloggers who make an art out of fisking, like analyzing and tearing apart every argument. But at some point, you have to make the decision that this is not good for you personally, and you have to say to yourself, I'm going to raise my hands and step away from the computer. I see flame wars all the time. I was the subject of a flame war involving an affiliate picture where two young women who were part of the Erotica Archive Service were posted as part of what's called the Sugasm. It's a weekly roundup of sex blogs. And another blogger took me to task for it. But if you looked clearly at this photo and the site it was run on, called the 2257 information was clearly displayed. And
so how did you handle being baited by this guy, which you were running pictures of underage girls, which
would
obviously be a big no-no?
I didn't want to engage him. Other bloggers who I know from my associations, many who I met at Sex2O in Atlanta, came to my defense and said, the 2257 information's right here. Why are you kind of conflating the issues of child porn when it's, you know, it really doesn't look like that? Why are you talking about your dislike for this person in the same post? We really don't get where you're coming from. So a lot of people with whom I had relationships said, we don't understand why you're attacking this person. She's very professional. What's up?
Okay.
So going back to privacy, personally identifiable information, there's lots of stuff out there. Let's remember how Sarah Palin's Yahoo account was reset, right? They knew her maiden name. They knew her date of birth. I think I put my date of birth as a couple years younger on the web, so no one can kind of figure that out. If you're writing about your children, maybe you should change the ages of your children, as perhaps Jefferson should have, okay? There are times when you want to monitor what's being said about you, but you don't want the site owner to know about that. So that's why I put the comment down about using a proxy server. So you may want to hide where you're coming from. You may want to use a program like... Yes, Jake? Did you have a question? Come speak in the mic, Jake. I was just about to talk about Tor because Tor can be used to disrupt traffic, even though I personally haven't used it.
Talk about Tor.
And introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Jake, and I work on the Tor project. So using a single hop proxy is actually a really bad idea because basically you have no real protection against traffic analysis. So if you're using a single hop proxy like Anonymizer, you're probably fine as long as your threat model doesn't include a world government or, say, the publishing company that you're using or like a WordPress blog. If someone can see that you're using Anonymizer and can correlate that with your blog posts, they would be able to pretty much like figure out who you are based on the content, right? Like the personal information is like a lot more than just your name. Like the style of your writing gives you away, the way that you use punctuation,
totally,
the frequency of words. And Tor is free software, so you don't have to pay snake oil companies. I mean, there are some that are good and there are some that are bad, but you don't have to pay snake oil companies to give you some sort of privacy that doesn't really have a real metric. And depending on if they have corrupt employees or if they don't provide real secure access, you could actually be putting yourself in a worse position because you think that you're safe, but you're not actually. And if you actually want to leak information or you want to blog anonymously or something like that, I'll totally help you set up Tor so that it works for you. And I won't tell anybody that I did so. If you're interested. And our webpage can explain that there are times when you want to use a single hop proxy, but if you know the difference between them, you'll be able to determine if you want to route through South Africa for free or if you want to go through like a company that you pay that's traceable to your credit card. So,
what's the URL?
www.torproject.org. And it's free software for macOS, Windows, and Linux, and it builds on every other operating system. We have a specification published, and it's run entirely by volunteers, so there's no financial incentive for us to promote it, really. It's just because we believe in anonymity and privacy. So.
Great, thanks.
I'm so glad that you were here to explain it so much better than I, because you worked on it. Okay. There may be times when you want to control your users. I've had people go crazy and make threats, so you, if you have a blog where you are logging your IP, such as LiveJournal or WordPress, there may be times when you want to block that user.
Let's tell a little story about that before we go on. Jeff Jarvis, who's a well-known journalist blogger, has talked about, you know, my blog is my living room, and if you don't follow my rules, I'm not going to let you hang out in my living room. And I think that people are totally entitled to ban or block people if they don't, quote, you know, follow their rules. It's nice if you tell them what your rules are, but, you know, if you do that, you certainly can set your own format. I had a troll at one point, and the troll tortured me, and it was someone I knew. And I finally figured out who the person was, and I said, you know, if you keep doing this, I'm going to show what you're writing up to your family. And the person said, well, let's meet and talk about it. I said, no, you just need to stop, okay? Like, you may think you're exercising free speech, but you're doing it in a really nasty way, targeted one person, me, not acceptable. And, you know, I think that all these rules are great, but ultimately, you know, what you have to remember is you have the power to decide what to do with them. It's your blog, it's your live stream, it's your data, and if somebody is giving you a hard time, there's no rule for you. You can do whatever you want. Do what makes you feel comfortable. There's no higher justice that you have to follow brand your own personal integrity.
Next slide, please. Okay, so let's talk about some of these things. I already see some hands raised.
So we want to throw this all back to you because obviously you are living in exactly the same world that we are. You're thinking about exactly the same kinds of things that we are, but thank God you're not us, so you'll actually have something different to say. So who has some comments and thoughts that they can share? We would love to, you know, turn this back so that this is a discussion, not a talking heads presentation. And I'm willing to give up this microphone to
okay.
help do that.
Okay. I'll play the cable guy 1 second. Okay.
Hi, Rose.
Hi, I'm Rose. So obviously I'm being transparent. One thing that's come up in graduate sociology courses that I'm taking right now, when the internet comes up, is the subject of forming identities. And I've noticed that people who don't study the internet professionally have a misconception that everyone who uses the internet plays with identity and keeps a sort of psychotic collection of multiple identities on the internet. This is this sort of weird idea that, you know, maybe I have six identities that I juggle on the internet, and I've been carefully explaining that many of us choose to be the same person everywhere online. And as Melissa Jira was saying, you know, you can't be blackmailed if you tell the truth about yourself. But as you're also pointing out here, the issue of transparency, if I use my real name and if I have a consistent reality across all of my accounts and all of my personas online, then there really isn't a sort of hidden agenda. It's my presentation of self. So I've been educating the CUNY sociology department on that.
How do other people here make decisions about what you're going to share and how much you're going to expose? Or if you have different personas that you use for different communities you're a part of, how do you make a decision of how to keep them separate, or, you know, when you want them to integrate or cross? Do people you're looking at just who've thought about that, that can share some of their own insights in their process?
Well, you have a thing up there, is this generational? And obviously I'm probably the only oldest guy here. But nonetheless, there is kind of a generational component. First off, I'm online as Uncle Abdul. I have a following that is kind of esoteric in a fairly large subculture, and well known within that subculture. Nonetheless, I come back from the old typewriter days and writing stuff by hand and things of that sort. So everything to me is a composition. I don't IM well. I don't chat well. As a matter of fact, I haven't chatted, and I don't IM anymore. So I can't, you know, like think on the fly or write on the fly, because I'm more interested in composing something that actually makes sense to me, at least, and has, you know, follows reasonable rules of grammar. And I actually run it through spell checker and things of that sort. So kind of different from what I see the younger generation do, particularly with a lot of brain dump and putting all their stuff as fast as their keyboard can work. I have some protection. Well, I consider that I have some protection in that I write about esoteric subjects. What I do write is in a compositional type of mode. A lot of people appreciate the stuff that I say, and the one or two occasions where some people took umbrage at this, I found ways of taking their words and in the same compositional fashion turn it around and says, you know, things like, well, obviously this points out the exact point that I was talking about, you know, and things of this sort. So that's a generational aspect of it.
Anybody on the other end of the spectrum, someone who's constantly taking photos and posting from their phone, who wants to just kind of be the contrast as to how you think about your own documentation?
Way in the back. What? Again?
Perfect.
We paid him to help us.
I used to take a lot of photographs and put them online until something pretty crappy happened, which was that they were used as a weapon against someone, and not someone that I wanted it to be used as a weapon against. So I actually stopped pretty much almost exclusively posting photographs because someone was outed actually on the internet, and the way that they were outed, those photographs were then used, they were under the Creative Commons, and they were then used on some commercial journalist sites, and they were used as like evidence of homosexuality. And they were, you know, pretty gay photographs if you looked at them in that light, but they were also completely straight, reasonable photographs if you didn't look them in that light. And so I stopped publishing almost all my photographs online because of like weird stalker type activity, but specifically that, because I think outing people unless they're Republicans trying to pass legislation is probably not the right course of action. I mean, in that case, you should hack their email and dump their shit on WikiLeaks. I mean, you know, it's not hard to find a birth date. But I stopped publishing for that exact reason, because I thought it was actually pretty crappy to participate in sort of like petty bickering that could result in maybe physical harm to someone.
Thanks for sharing that.
Thanks. One of my experiences, as well as several other people I know, in terms of going public with your blog or your life, when I first started doing the LiveJournal thing, it was very much a raw emotional purging of whatever was going on in my life right then. And I was, it was very narcissistic. I wasn't worried about grammar or punctuation or any of that nonsense because, you know, the true message was there for me, and that was the most important person it was there for. And as I kept it up over the next few years, it started to become important to me that other people understand the message that I was trying to put out there. And so I started going back to the rules I learned in school of grammar and punctuation and trying to form the sentences as carefully and as clearly as I could. So over a few years' time, it became one of the most important tools for improving my skill as a writer. And so, yes, and I think that some of the things that I posted about definitely changed. You know, it's not as common now to be posting a raw emotional purge, or if I do, it's a much more carefully thought out, better punctuated raw emotional purge. But at the same time, it very much assisted all of the other areas of developing the craft as well. And so I think that that's one answer to, you know, one of the ways that it can be positive for people. And I know I'm not the only person that that's happened to.
Other questions or comments that people have?
Okay. Hi, I'm Leslie. I kind of joined the internet community, blogging, being online, pretty later than probably most of my friends. And it was an interesting experience on tribe.net. I started a tribe that actually became a social tribe. Like, it was a huge tribe. It was a neighborhood tribe right here in the Mission. And what happened is that I met most of the people who were on my friends list, and I had like 400 people on my friends list, and I kind of was particular about that. But I didn't know these people really, and they, you know, I know them to say hello to or whatever. And there was this weird situation where people acted like they knew me, and or they knew a lot more about me than I think that they had any right to. And so what happened as a result of that for me is that I became I came into the internet world with a bang, and then I started getting much less transparent. And so when I went over to other things like LiveJournal or Twitter, I don't want a lot of people following me. I don't want those people that I kind of know following me. I just want the people that I know. And it's just became this sort of important thing for me that, you know, occasionally I'll let somebody slip through, but I really, really need my privacy.
People sometimes post about when they will accept someone on Facebook as a friend, when they will accept someone on Twitter. I know Susan has probably 1,000 followers, and she says, I'll look and see if they're a real person instead of a spammer, and if they are, I'll accept them. I feel pretty much the same way. I know for my privacy, I have distinct Facebook accounts, distinct email accounts. I'm very careful to not overlap or cross them. I'm also very careful to monitor who's looking at my blog.
I think the other point just worth sharing, and you know, we all know this, is that if you don't have some kind of digital identity today, you're weird, right? It's like if people search for you and nothing comes up, that's even more strange than having your like high school drunkenness appear, They're kind of like, is this person really authentic? You know, so I think that where these narratives become relevant is that, you know, whether it's inadvertent because of things people scrape or it's deliberate because of things that we contribute, you know, you do have a digital identity and there is a narrative about it that you get to construct either by default, by just putting up things and letting, you know, Google or any aggregator display them, or by you taking some control of that. And I just don't want to forget, because I know it's been powerful for me, and I think it's powerful for everyone here, you know, how much that sharing can also bring people together. I mean, we became friends, and this person is a very good friend of mine, because we had so much in common, even though we lived on two opposite coasts. And, you know, I have a number of friends where I've either met or deepened friendships because we found that there were these points of connection that in the real world we either would not have met or it would have taken a lot longer. So, you know, as much as we're talking about oversharing and how to, you know, protect your authenticity by not being connected shallowly to too many people, there's real power to this kind of narrative that, you know, kind of informs the starting place, I think, for all these kind of discussions.
Any additional comments? Observations?
Okay.
Risa and I and Steve had a kind of interesting experience with transparency on our blog, where we have a household blog that we put up, and shortly after we put it up, someone who was more into the Fisking end of blogging decided to go on a little Google treasure hunt and decided to post in their blog this sort of expose of how their favorite author, being our housemate Steve, was living with another guy and a woman, although he interestingly gave my name but not Risa's. She was just a woman. And it was interesting because our response was pretty blasé. I mean, we didn't ever actively seek out to hide that. We all have a blog together that's our household blog. People can guess that we live together. But he seemed to feel that, like, he put, like, this most dramatic spin that he could on it. It was almost like, it's almost like the internet makes everybody into an investigative journalist when they're trying to find out who someone is.
How true is that? We should probably wrap. Any last words, comments, questions?
Next slide. Can you, next slide, please? Okay.
So just so we remain findable.
Here's our contact information, and we are also going to repost this presentation with some additional links on SlideShare, and we'll also make the presentation available on our blogs. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, thanks.